A number of years ago, Mary Crowley made a statement. She said that one person with a commitment is worth more than 100 who only have an interest. I'm convinced that people who make commitments to reach their goals are the ones who are going to reach them. A number of years ago, a young coach at the University of South Carolina was fired after his first season on his first job. Not only did the head coach say, "No more for you here," but he advised him to get out of coaching. He said, "Let's face it, you just don't have it." But the young coach had set his goal. He had made a commitment. He had said, "Someday I'm going to coach at the University of Notre Dame." Ohio State gave him a chance, and he was an assistant there for a couple of years. Then William and Mary called him, and he was their head coach. And then North Carolina State University called him, and for 4 years there, he had the best one-loss record they'd ever had. From there, he went into the pros and coached the New York Jets for a season, but he really missed coaching the young men and helping mold their character. And then University of Arkansas called him and had a phenomenally successful career there. He built the best one-loss record they had ever had. He went to the Orange Bowl, I believe it was in 1979. And before he went down to play the University of Oklahoma, the media had speculated that it would be a mismatch, that Oklahoma simply was too powerful. To compound the problem, three offensive players, as a matter of fact, the entire offense of that Arkansas team, were caught with a woman in the room. They explored, investigated, discovered that it was absolutely true, and the coach immediately dismissed all three players. The media again speculated that what he should do is decline the invitation of the Orange Bowl, let somebody else accept the invitation who would be a worthy opponent for the Oklahoma team. But the coach was a committed man. He looked at what he did have left and didn't worry about what he did not have. They accentuated the positive, if you will. They developed a specific game plan. The rest is history. They won the game. I believe it was by about 31-6. He left the University of Arkansas and became the head coach at the University of Minnesota. Now, when he accepted the Minnesota assignment, he said to them, "I will take the assignment provided you will give me one out. And that is that if the University of Notre Dame calls me to be their head coach, and if I take this team to a bowl within 2 years," there he is with those goals again. Well, 2 years later, the University of Minnesota was invited to play in a bowl, and the University of Notre Dame called Lou Holtz to be their head coach. Now, the interesting thing is this. They called him to be their head coach the day he dismissed those three players from his team when he was at the University of Arkansas several years earlier. Now, they made their decision then. They didn't put the call into him. But when that happened, they said, "Here is a man who is interested in building character and developing leaders. There's the man we want to be our coach the next time we have an opening as the head coach at Notre Dame University." I'm obviously talking about Lou Holtz. I happen to know Lou quite well. We've been on seminars together. We've corresponded together. We've spent a little time together. He said that there never was any doubt in his mind about dismissing those players. It was the right thing to do. What I'm saying is this. When you've got a solid base with a solid commitment and solid objectives, you've got a much better chance of reaching your goal. But it does take those commitments. When I wrote my book, See You at the Top, the first words I wrote were, as I said earlier, you can go where you want to go, do what you want to do, and be like you want to be. When I worked on the goal segment in there, I put in the book that I weighed 165 pounds, that I had a 34-inch waistline. The moment I wrote that, and it was typeset, I had a 41-inch waistline and weighed over 200 pounds. I had made a commitment to get that weight off, and I put it in print that I was going to do exactly that. Not only that, but when I'd finished the first summation of the book and had written the chapter headings and a little bit of the content, I sent it to three major publishers, knowing that they would really be elated to get this book from this unknown author. I knew that in all reality, those three publishers would get in a bidding war, and they would fight each other about who's going to have the honor of publishing this book. You can imagine my shock, chagrin, and disappointment when I got letters from all three of them saying, we don't think the book was going to sell. Well, I knew better. But folks, there's one thing for me to say to the publisher, publish it. If it sells, pay me my royalties. If it does not sell, well, gee, I'm sure sorry about that. It's one thing for me to get them to invest their money, but the question is, Ziegler, do you really believe this philosophy that you've been talking about all over the country? Do you really believe that this book will sell? I had to make a decision. I decided since no one else would publish a book, I'd publish it myself. A friend of mine said, Zig, if you sell 25,000 copies, you got a bestseller. Well, that appealed to me enormously. I decided to print up 25,000 copies. Now, I don't know what you know about book publishing, but let me tell you something very basic about it. First of all, the first copy will cost you more than the next 24,999 copies. The second thing about it is those 24,999 copies cost a whole bunch of money, especially if you don't have it. I decided, though, that I believed the book would sell. I decided to go ahead and publish that book. That is commitment. Can you imagine me with a warehouse full of books saying I weighed 165 pounds and I come waddling out at 202? I would still have a warehouse full of books. Let me tell you what human nature is like. I lie to you one time about one thing, and from here on in, you're going to have a question mark after everything I tell you. Is this not so? You lie to me one time about one thing, and I know it is a deliberate lie. I'm going to put a question mark after everything you tell me from here on in. Had I not lost that weight, I could well imagine a lot of people looking at me and reading a book, and this says 165, and I'm seeing 202. I would imagine them saying, I wonder what else he lied about. Ladies and gentlemen, you must make the commitment. That's step number one if you expect to reach your goal. Step number two, you need to keep that daily detailed accountability. I can say it 4,000 different ways, but the bottom line is this. Unless you discipline yourself on a daily basis to keep records of what you're doing, it will take you a maximum of 10 minutes. Unless you discipline yourself to do these things, though, the chances are very, very strong that you are not going to reach your goals. You simply lose sight of what you say is extremely important to you. Then there's this other thing each evening, and that is your plans for tomorrow. Just before I came down here this evening, I placed a telephone call to my friend Lon Shealy up in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Those of you who are close enough can see in this picture, there is a man seated at a desk. There is a high stack of 5x8 cards alongside of him. I have not counted them, but Lon Shealy tells me there are 3,100 cards in that stack. Those represent his daily commitment every day for the last 3,100 days of his career. Let me tell you what I'm getting at. A number of years ago, a consultant named Ivy Lee called on a man named Charles Schwab, who was the president of U.S. Steel. He said, I know as busy as you are, Mr. Schwab, you're going to need all the help you can get in having your activities directed at the things which are the most important and the most profitable for you and for the company. I will give you an idea which will dramatically increase your effectiveness. The entire interview lasted 15 minutes. The idea Ivan Lee gave to Charles Schwab was this. Each evening before you go to bed, list the 6 most important things which you have to do tomorrow. Tomorrow morning, then, you start working on number 1. And if it takes you all day long to complete number 1, remember you have already decided that is the most important thing for you to be doing. What Lon Seely said to me was, is that for 3,100 consecutive days, and assuming that you work about 230 days each year, you've got about 15 years of cards stacked up right there. I asked Lon, did it work? He said, Zig, the results speak pretty well for themselves. Lon is the new retired vice chairman of Star Buildings. He retired as the president. He's kind of on a consultant basis there, goes in from time to time. He said, you know, Zig, a number of years ago, Peter Drucker made a couple of observations that fit this down to the T. He said, number one, know thy time. That's what we're talking about with this. Number two, you focus on the contribution that you can make. Focus on the contribution. Know your time. That's exactly what you are doing with this. Now, once each week, you remember we're only working on 4 to 6 things, but once each week, you need to look at all of the goals which are still on your list. For example, there are some 34 things on my goals list right now. I do not work on all of them every week. That is impossible. Some of them are not designed to be worked on every week. But each week, I make a decision which one of them I'm going to be working on this week. You need to review them. Now, during the course of the week, in my performance planner, if I don't do anything at all that day on that goal, what I do is I write nothing in red. At the end of the week, I can spend 5 seconds and I can just glance at what I have done that week, and I can instantly know if I'm headed for trouble. If I miss it one day, that's not a big deal. If I miss it 2 days, maybe I better start exploring because I'm headed for some trouble there. Step number two is you get involved in this daily detailed accountability. I say it again, it will take you only about 10 minutes each evening to do these. Number three, if you're going to reach your goals, you've got to start with a solid foundation. Now, that foundation is honesty and character and integrity and loyalty and trust and love, or faith for trust there for some of you. I was in Calgary, Canada once here about, I guess it's 5 or 6 years ago. Had a chance to go up on Calgary Tower to have dinner. When we stepped on the elevator, the little cassette recording came on. The recording said, this tower is 626 feet high. Now, I cannot visualize 626 feet straight up unless I think of 2 football fields and then 26 more feet. Now, I can relate to that. So that was a picture I had of it. The recording said this structure weighs 13,000 tons, and 7,000 of those tons are underground. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you got a foundation like that, you can go 626 feet up in the air or even higher. Go to downtown Dallas or any city in the world, and a good engineer can look at a hole in the ground and tell you how wide, how broad, and how tall the building is going to be just by looking at the kind of foundation they're going to have. I can tell you, I don't care whether your future lies in athletics or entertainment or music or sales or education or law or medicine, it makes zero difference what your future is in, where your goals are. But I can tell you this, if you've got a solid foundation to build on, the odds are dramatically increased that you're going to reach your goals. I'd like to share this with you, personal opinion. I believe it has more than just an opinion as far as validity is concerned. Dr. Bill Kirby, Commissioner for Education for the state of Texas, went to Japan about a year ago. I read an article about his visit when he came back. I'd been reading a lot of the books, Japan is Number One, many articles and other things about what the Japanese are doing. But you know, it's one thing to hear things, it's something else to see those things. That's the reason we went by Japan on the other trips. What Dr. Kirby said was, starting in the first grade, and going through the 12th grade, 1 hour a day, first grade through 12th grade, the Japanese teach a one-hour course. It teaches their kids the importance of honesty and character and integrity and positive thinking and goal setting and free enterprise and responsibility and respect for authority and respect for elders. What they are doing is really establishing from the very beginning what the work ethic is all about. Now, please don't misunderstand this. I would not live in Japan. There's nothing quite like America. But I believe fervently, ladies and gentlemen, that we can learn some lessons from them. And if we don't learn those lessons, we're going to be in trouble. Here's a little nation half the size of Texas, has 120 million people, no natural resources, and yet they're the largest creditor nation in the world. 8 of the top 10 publicly held corporations in the world are Japanese. 8 of the top 10 banks in the world are Japanese. Economically, they're the dominant factor in the world today. Now, why is it? There might be a lot of reasons, but I'm absolutely convinced that this is one of the major reasons right here. We went into the plant over there that manufactures Quasar TV. They have roughly 2,000 employees. We were there in July. In June, they had set their goal. That plant was to produce 11,500 ideas for improvement. And their goal was that 65% of them were to be usable. In other words, none of this wild, off-the-wall stuff. Very definite objectives. They had just published their goals. They had come up with 11,700 new ideas. But only 62 of them were usable. Now, what am I saying with all of this? I'm saying that these principles work. For a nation, for a family, for an individual, and for a company. But you got to have a solid foundation. Dr. Mortimer Feinberg wrote a book. It's entitled Corporate Bigamy. He's a PhD from New York City. In his book, he tells of interviewing 100 top CEOs in the Fortune 500. He asks the question, what is necessary to go to the top in your career and stay there? And the consensus was this. You build your career on honesty and character and integrity, and they threw in the word motivation. They summed it up by saying anybody who thinks they can go to the top and stay there who's not honest is dumb. That's about as strong as you can get. And yet over 70% of all of the business men, they're not as hard on you ladies, over 70% of the business men depicted on television are depicted as con artists and or crooks. The exact opposite of the reality of life. Step number 4, if you want to reach your goals, you need to change your vocabulary. Now, so well remember, when that opportunity clock would sound off every morning at 5:30, I was jogging in the morning in those days. That opportunity clock would sound off and I'd reach over there and shut it off. And you know, a lot of people have asked me, now tell me the truth, Secular, did you really enjoy getting up and doing all of that running? I'm going to tell you, I absolutely hated it. Clock would sound off, I'd reach over and shut it off, and I'd lay there thinking to myself, Ziegler, what's a 46-year-old fat boy like you doing, getting up running all over the neighborhood? Then I'd look down at that 41-inch waistline, and I'd say, Ziegler, do you want to look like you, or do you want to look like the guy in the jockey shorts? Well, I didn't want to look like me, So I would crawl out of bed feeling like a martyr. I mean, did I ever feel like a martyr? I'd put on that fancy running outfit and I'd head for the front door and I'd start jogging. But I was grumbling all the way. What you trying to do out here? You're going to kill your silly self out here. But you said you were going to do it, and so you're going to do it. Oh, and don't you think I didn't tell people all over the country about the sacrifice I was making, how I would get up in the morning and do this thing because I was committed to do it, and if I'm committed to do it, I'm going to do it. Oh, if I said it once, I said it 1,000 times. I would raise my voice and say, you got to pay the price. What a bunch of baloney that is. Sound like a dying calf in a snowstorm. The reality is, I was in Portland, Oregon. Beautiful spring day. Temperature about 78 degrees. High noon. I was running on the campus there at Portland State University. And as I was jogging that day, all of a sudden I became aware of the fact that I was breathing easily. The ground was flowing smoothly beneath my feet. And that day, ladies and gentlemen, for the first time I understood, you don't pay the price for good health. You enjoy the benefits of good health. You don't pay the price for success. You pay the price for failure. I've never seen a happy failure. You don't pay the price for a good marriage. You pay the price for a poor one. You enjoy the benefits of a good one. If you really want to reach your goal, what I'm saying is you need to change your vocabulary. You do. Step number 5. If you want to reach your goal, you need to divide it into small bites. When I was writing the book and losing the weight, when the doctor told me to lose the 37 pounds, he didn't tell me how long to take to do it. I was writing the book at that point, and I figured, based on what I'd already done, that it would take me 10 months to write the book. So I said, well, if it's going to take me 10 months to write the book, I'll just lose the weight as I'm writing the book, and I'll break it down, and I will lose 3 7/10 pounds a month. Now, remember earlier we said you've got to be able to see yourself as already reaching there. You got to emotionally commit yourself to do it and be able to visualize believing that you can get there. Well, I knew that I could lose 3 7/10 pounds a month. You see, that's not even a pound a week. I was totally, completely, 100% confident that I could do it. I was so confident, as a matter of fact, that I didn't even bother to get started for 29 days. How many of you know exactly what I'm talking about? When I was a boy down in Yazoo City, Mississippi, we lived next door to some rich folks. I know they were rich for two reasons. Number one, they had a cook. Number two, the cook had something to cook. And during the Depression, that was a sure sign of wealth, I'll guarantee you. I was over there for lunch one day, as I tried to be every day. And don't misunderstand, even though there was a Depression on, we certainly had plenty to eat at my house. I know we had plenty because if I ever passed my plate for seconds, they'd always tell me. No, you've had plenty. So I know we had plenty. Cook brought the biscuits out, and this is not an exaggeration. Those biscuits were no thicker than my wristwatch. And I looked at him. I said, Maude, what on earth happened to your biscuits? She reared back, gave that big old tummy laugh, and said, well, I'll tell you about those biscuits. She said they squatted to rise. But she said they just got cooked in the squat. You know anybody gets cooked in the squat? You know anybody who's a half-a-minder and a gonna-doer? You know, they're gonna-do-this when, or they're a half-a-mind to do that now, but, you know, the half-a-minders and the gonna-doers invariably end up being the never-doers. You ever see the individual, you know, that said, I really want to get involved in this project, but it's really almost time for the kids to get out of school. When the kids get out of school, I'm having to take them to so many of the parties now. And when school is out, then I'll really get busy. When school is out, they say, well, you know, I didn't realize it, but now I got to take them somewhere it looks like all the time. I have to do it more now than I did when they were in school. Wait till the kids get back in school, then I'll really get busy. Kids get back in school and they say, well, for the first time in 23 years, dear old Central High has finally got a winning football season. And you got to support the kids, you know that. Wait till after football season is over, then I'll really get involved. Football season ends and they say, well, you know, here it is, Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's, and people just don't want to be bothered this time of the year. Wait till after the holidays, then we can all get a fresh start. After the holidays, they say, well, you know, it's the weather. Have you ever seen weather like this around Dallas or St. Louis or San Diego or New Jersey or wherever? You know, you just don't know. From one day to the next, it's just a mess. Wait until the weather kind of settles down. Now, wait a minute. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking I've lost interest. But just a minute. Let me tell you the way I'm seeing. Now, here's the way I do things. I get everything all lined up in the proper order and get all of my ducks in a row. I get my plans made. And then when I do get started, man, I really get after it. I mean, I just found that works better for me. Now, some of these other people, they might be ahead of me right now, but I mean, this is what works best for me. Wait till after the weather settles down, then I'll really get after it. The weather settles down, they say, well, here it is, Easter time. And you know, Easter time is family time, and you said it yourself, family is most important. Wait till I've had some family time. Then they have some family time, and they say, well, you know, at long, long last, we got some decent weather, and I haven't hit a golf ball or wet a hook in I don't know when. And you know yourself, you can't work all the time. Fellas got to have some time off. Wait till I hit a few golf balls, and then, man, I'll really get after it. They hit a few golf balls, then you know what they say? Well, it's time for the kids to get back out of school. Now, folks, you can put this in your pipe and smoke it, as we'd say down home. The folks who wait for Aunt Matilda to move out or John to get on the day shift. The people who wait for the primaries to end or the new senator to be elected. The people who wait for the rate of interest to drop or inflation to slow down. The people who wait for the new advertising campaign to get started or the new model to come out. The people who wait on changes out there before they make decisions and take actions internally are invariably going to end up getting cooked in the squat. What I'm saying is we need to start it right now. You know what I discovered? I discovered that if I lost 1 9/10 ounces a day, that 10 months later, to the inch, to the ounce, and to the day, I would lose the weight. And that is exactly what happened right there. Exactly. My book, see you at the top, 384 pages. Sold, counting foreign editions, over 2 million copies. I wrote 1 1/4 pages a day, every day, for 10 months. Let me tell you how to build a magnificent marriage. It's not the great honeymoon, it's not the big Christmas or the big vacation. It's the little acts every day of time and respect and affection and courtesy that you show to each other. You raise positive kids in a negative world by the daily injections of love and direction and concern you have for your kids. You build a magnificent career, regardless of what it is that you're doing, by the little things that you do every day that are designed to make a difference. It is the series of little things that will determine whether you get there or not. Now, let me stress something here. What I'm really talking about is simply a direction and an organization of your time frame. I'm suggesting that you, by following these procedures, will be taking control. 90% of all independent people, particularly in the world of sales and entrepreneurial organizations and medicine and law and so many of the other things, are dictated to and subjected to the whims of just about everybody that comes and goes, imposing on their time and giving them things to do or dumping loads on them, and they don't know how to get out of it. When we've got direction in our lives, for some reason, busy people seem to be in control of their lives. You need to become a time miser.